Today on Blue 58, the Packers seem all but set at both quarterback and running back, but there's reason to think they're in the market for more. How do you find a good one at quarterback, and who's looking good in this year's class at running back?
Blue 58!
Hello and welcome to another episode of Blue 58, the one and only podcast of thepowersweep.com. I am your host, John Meerdink, and I am thrilled again to be with you here for another episode. Just every episode that goes by, we get to do another one. We're up to 752 as I look up at my notes again today. And just, man, it's good to be here. Fun to be talking NFL draft. And it's coming quickly. We're a little bit more than a month away. So let's talk about the position that turns the most heads each and every year. We're talking about quarterbacks. Previewing quarterbacks is always tough for this specific podcast because the Packers, in the time that we've been doing this, and really, as I think of it, in the time that I've been a Packers fan, I mean, I was born in 1988, dating myself immediately, like literally there. So by the time like I was conscious of the Packers, Brett Favre was already a thing. And of course, we know how things played out with Aaron Rodgers becoming a Green Bay Packers draft pick and subsequently with Jordan Love. All that to say, the Packers have never gone into the NFL draft thinking, by golly, we got to get a quarterback here, or we are in real trouble. So we've never really had to preview the position. On top of that, I think previewing quarterbacks is almost so difficult as to be pointless beyond the first round. And in the first round, everybody knows who the big names are. And the difference between those big names is so slight that it's going to come down to a lot of non-talent-related things, I think, that will make or break those players. So looking at that from a preview perspective, the Packers don't really need one. It's really tough to figure out who the good guys are, and it gets to be a super-duper crapshoot in the late rounds. I thought we would look at a couple of just general thoughts about the quarterback position. First, drafting and developing a quarterback. Two big thoughts here. I think fit is more important than talent at a certain point. So talking about quarterbacks who could conceivably go in the first round, I think where you land is as important as what you are as a player. Because I think the right guy in the right place is going to go a lot farther than the right guy in the wrong place. Look at Jimmy Garoppolo in San Francisco for most of his time there versus Jimmy Garoppolo just about anywhere else. Look at Geno Smith in Seattle versus Geno Smith most other places in his career. Look at Jordan Love in Green Bay. Look at Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay. Look at Brett Favre in Green Bay. Shoot, let's go all the way to King Bart himself. Look at Bart Starr in Green Bay. He was barely Bart Starr in Green Bay until a guy named Vince Lombardi came along. Throw Patrick Mahomes in there as well. Landing in the right spot is going to help you a lot more than just talent alone. Now, I think there are worlds when you talk about those ultra successful guys like Aaron Rodgers, like Patrick Mahomes. There is a world where they end up being very good players if they land somewhere else. But I don't think it should be a controversial statement to talk about, how a guy's fit played into his career. Does Patrick Mahomes come along as quickly if he has to start right away day one? He's even talked about what a learning experience it was for him to sit for a while in Kansas City and just get used to the speed of the NFL and how everything is different and what you have to do to be an NFL quarterback. That is valuable, I think. So then kind of a related question, if you're trying to create a good fit for that quarterback, how do you build a situation so you can develop a quarterback? I think there's a few things that are going to play into this. I think first you need to have somebody who's going to be the starter for at least a season. So Jordan Love had Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers had Brett Favre. Patrick Mahomes had Alex Smith. You can find other examples of that. Michael Vick, there's an example for you. The first overall pick in the draft sits for most of his rookie season behind, do you remember who it was? You'll probably date yourself as a football fan if you do, Chris Chandler. The crystal chandelier to some NFL fans, but he sat for a while too. You need somebody who is going to be the starter for at least a season, and I think importantly, they have to be the unquestioned starter. It can't be a situation where you come into training camp and you'd like to sit your rookie, but is he really better than, I don't know, pick a low-level starting quarterback in the NFL. I don't want to pick on anybody, so we're not going to throw out a name there. But if you're drafting this guy in the first round and you can, and you're not sure that the guy that you're going to be starting instead of him is going to be better than him, it's going to feel like you're wasting everybody's time really quickly there. So you also need a coaching staff and a front office who are capable of riding out the ups and downs. This is the really hard part, and this is what the Packers have had working for them in both the Brett Favre to Aaron Rodgers transition and the Aaron Rodgers to Jordan Love transition. They had a stable organization in place. It's nice to have. It's crucial to have. It's not something you can just say that you have unless you have an unusually stable and committed front office. Looking at the guys, looking at the teams at the top of the draft order this year, a lot of the quarterback needy teams are really hard, I think, to characterize as super stable organizations. But that's the rub, isn't it? Because the guys or the teams that should be super stable organizations or the teams that are super stable organizations generally aren't picking in the range where they can take a guy in the draft and then sit him for a while. That's the catch-22. In our quarterback development question, I think league-wide, if you want to have better quarterback play, they probably do need some time to develop. Let's just put it this way. They may not even need to sit, but they need some time where the pressure isn't as great to be the guy from the jump. But if you're drafting at the top of the draft, chances are you do need that guy to be the guy from the start. I mean, whoever goes to the Bears first overall, whether it's Caleb Williams or somebody else, you know, he's going to have to carry that team from the get-go because they traded the only guy that they could have reasonably asked to do that in Justin Fields. And you can go back and forth about what Justin Fields is or should be as a player, but he's at least done it in the NFL. And he's been a starting quarterback week in and week out. He knows how to be a pro football player. Whoever the Bears end up picking is not going to be in that situation. He's going to have to be their starting quarterback from the second he walks across the stage and shakes Roger Goodell's hand. Building that kind of culture is almost impossible, and it puts you in a real bind development-wise if you don't have it, because your coach has got to put up or shut up right away. Your general manager's job is on the line, and if your owner has a quick trigger finger, they might not get a lot of time to work with this incredibly valuable asset that you have as a young developing quarterback. And then you need a prospect who actually can develop. That sounds like a really obvious thing, but I think it's a trickier statement than we are led to believe. I think there is a perception that any quarterback who's drafted, you know, above a certain number can become good enough to be like a franchise quarterback. But I don't think there's any evidence that shows that is the case. Because if it were, I think teams would be better at drafting quarterbacks. If there was a way to figure out who's going to be an elite quarterback, or maybe who's going to become an elite quarterback, let's put it that way, because there are some guys that you take in the draft who have all of the traits, who looks like, you know, they're as clean as a whistle as a prospect. Your Trevor Lawrences, your Andrew Lux, those kinds of guys don't come along all that often. Everybody else, you're projecting a little bit. And if there was a surefire way to project who was going to be an elite quarterback versus who isn't, somebody would have figured it out by now. And it fools a lot of people every year. Here's the classic example. People love to dump truck the Bears, and I'm going to defend the Chicago Bears here for a second. Don't get me wrong, I will still point and laugh at the Chicago Bears for doing this, but they would have, there's a lot of people in their positions that would have done the exact same thing as they did when they took Mitchell Trubisky over Deshaun Watson and over Patrick Mahomes. And I know that for an absolute fact. There were a lot of people who agreed with that decision. Looking back at the data, it was widely considered a weak quarterback class. Let's look at the mock draft database's consensus mock drafts for that year, 2017. Trubisky was the consensus top guy start to finish in that pre-draft process. There was really never a scenario where anybody else was considered a lot higher than him. But according to the same database, most people doing mock drafts league-wide or around the internet, wherever you want to characterize it, didn't put any of the quarterbacks particularly high in that class. Trubisky was the highest rated of the three quarterbacks at the top there. He was only considered the 13th best prospect in the class. Watson was 15th. Mahomes was 22nd. For most of the pre-draft process, Mahomes was looked at as a borderline first-round pick. This is not my opinion. This is the consensus take of the whole draft industrial project, industry, whatever. The people who are doing this, who are putting this out there, thought that Patrick Mahomes was going to be a late first-round, early second-round pick. The numbers show that. The mock drafts from the time show that. And yet, Patrick Mahomes is by far the best of those three guys. It's not even a conversation. Mahomes is orders of magnitude better than both of those guys put together. Watson alone is way better than Trubisky. But if there was a surefire process to know what those guys were going to turn into at the next level, the Bears never would have taken Trubisky over those other two guys. Nobody would be that stupid, but they were looking at different things, and everybody must have been looking at those same things because everybody wanted Trubisky towards the top. Watson gave him a little bit of competition, but for most of that pre-draft process, it was Trubisky, the consensus top quarterback in the draft. So it's just hard to draft quarterbacks. And yet, Brian Gutekunst wants to draft more of them. This is the other thing I really wanted to talk about regarding quarterbacks in this year's draft. Brian Gutekunst said he wants to get back, and the exact quote was that he wants to get back to drafting multiple quarterbacks, which I think was a slight bit of misspeaking on his behalf, because the Packers really have not drafted multiple quarterbacks as a rule in single draft classes. The only time they've done it in the 21st century was 2008, when they took Brian Brown and Matt Flynn in the same draft. What I think he's referring to is Ron Wolf's practice of taking a quarterback every year. And he did that just about every year from 1992 to 1999. In that 8-year span, he drafted seven quarterbacks. In 1992, he took Ty Detmer with pick number 230, which doesn't exist anymore. In 1933, with the 118th pick, he took Mark Brunell. With pick 160 in 1995, he took Jay Barker. In 96 and 97, with pick 240 in both drafts, he took Kyle Wacholtz and Ron McAdda. In 98, he took Matt Hasselbeck. And in 1999, he took Aaron Brooks. And the idea with taking those guys is either you find a guy who's going to be the next franchise quarterback for you, or eventually you can flip them for somebody else. And I actually went back and pulled on all those threads today, or not today, yesterday, doesn't matter, to see what became of all those quarterbacks. Of those seven, three never played a snap in the NFL. Barker, Wacholtz, and McAdda never made it out of camp. Their links in the draft history on Pro Football Reference are black. They do not go anywhere. There is no playing career for any of those three guys. It would be fun to track them down, though. You were a Packers draft pick in the mid-90s during the middle of their Super Bowl years with Ron Wolf. What was that like? Maybe we'll have to find them and ask them at some point. Ty Detmer eventually left the Packers as a free agent. Mark Brunell was traded to the Jacksonville Jaguars for two draft picks, pick 66 and pick 170. Those turned into William Henderson and Travis Jervey. Matt Hasselbeck and Aaron Brooks were both traded as a part of the 2001 draft pick or draft class. It gets a little complicated in terms of what the Packers all got out of those picks. But we'll break it down really quickly here. The Packers use Hasselbeck and one of their draft picks to trade up, Hasselbeck and the 17th pick in the draft to trade up with the Seahawks for the 10th pick and the 72nd pick. The 10th pick turned into Jamal Reynolds, who was a huge bust, and Torrance Marshall was the 72nd pick. If you want to call him a bust, you can, but pick 72, you're getting kind of out of bust territory at that point. He really wasn't ever anything for the Packers. The Packers flipped Aaron Brooks to the Saints for pick 82 and linebacker K.D. Williams. Then pick 82 was packaged with some other draft picks so the Packers could move up in the second and third rounds. They came out of that whole deal with Robert Ferguson, Bao Ju, and Bill Ferrario. Outside of William Henderson, I think you could argue that nobody in those picks really drafted or really turned into anything. However, if you just look at the draft picks the Packers accumulated by trading those quarterbacks, Ron Wolf created about 1,500 points of excess draft value, surplus draft value, using the Jimmy Johnson trade value chart, which is what I think would have been in practice at the time. There are other models that are more popular now, or maybe more accurate now is the better way of looking at it. But he got the Packers a lot out of those picks. The net of that, just in terms of draft capital, ended up being pretty darn good. And the Packers were never hurting for drafting or for backup quarterbacks through the late 90s and early 2000s because Ron Wolf was so solid with those picks. I think if you turn it into a good investment, it's a good idea. If you can turn it into an investment, it's a good idea. And it makes you a little bit more stable behind your starting quarterback. I do balk a little bit at the idea of drafting a guy that you're hoping is never going to play. But maybe you're just, from an investment perspective, picking some green bananas at that point, and you're hoping they turn into yellow bananas at some point that you can sell. And shoot, if you're looking to launder some draft picks and create some more value down the road, that's not a bad way to go about it at the most valuable position in the sport, but it's a tricky thing to do because for a lot of their time, hopefully for their entire time with your team, they're not going to be playing at all, which gets a little bit tricky from a value perspective if they don't end up turning into anything at all. But shoot, for a team as stable as what the Packers appear to be, maybe it's not all that bad of an idea. Switching gears, let's talk running backs for a little while here. Overall impressions of this class, not the best one we've seen in a while. We looked at 250 players in the data we captured, 24 running backs in that top 250, which sounds like a nice number. Almost 10% of the top 250 players by consensus in this year's draft are running backs, but none of them are in the top 50. There's just five in the top 150 or so. Of those running backs in our sample of those 24, there aren't many great athletes. A lot of them are not testing this year either because they seem to fear that their testing numbers would not be good or because they're injured, which is a problem with a lot of college running backs. Some of those guys are getting to the NFL pretty used up at one of the most physically demanding spots in the entire sport. Only 9 of 24 with elite relative athletic scores just because of the testing. Just as kind of an aside, this is, to me, one of the most fun positions to watch in the pre-draft process and just throughout all of football, because running backs are kind of what make me romantic about football. I know the position has been devalued, but there's just something about a great back in football working in tandem with a terrific offensive line that just seems like the best, purest expression of the sport. You can look at video, and it's 70 years old at this point, of Vince Lombardi talking about running plays that have just the complexity of a high-end pocket watch, but then they get executed with speed and power, all these moving parts working in front of this back, and then charging through a hole, running to daylight, and hitting top gear just as he sprints past the last defender who's like flailing and trying to reach for him but can't because his road grader teammates have cleared the way ahead of them. You've got this legendary, beautiful athlete, speed and power breaking into the open field and taking it all the way to the touch for a touchdown. And you can, as you picture it in your mind, you can almost hear the crowd getting louder and anticipating what's about to happen. And suddenly there he is bursting into the open field and you've got a highlight reel play. All those complex, amazing running plays can go big, but they're primarily just yard gainers. And I think that is the core essence of football, trying to get 5 to 6 to 8 yards at a time. And the best part is, if you can keep getting 4, 5, 6 yards on a play, you can carve your way right down the field. And if they cannot physically match you, there's nothing your opponent can do to stop you. And it just is, again, the purest expression of football there is. And I know, I get it. I've read all the same stuff, all the analytics stuff that you have. But just so many of the things that are taken as conventional wisdom about the running game and running backs too aren't borne out by the data. But they're fun because even if the data doesn't always support them, they feel true. You know, wearing people down with a big bruising back that people don't want to tackle. Playing hard in the run. Setting up play-action pass by having a dominant run game, establishing the run. Nobody's ever actually been able to tell me what establishing the run actually is, But it feels like something that should be true. Like, how many carries do you actually need to establish the run? Is it 10? Is it 5? Is it 3? Is it 2? If the run is big enough, do you just need one run to establish the run? How many does it take? Do you have to reestablish the run if you establish it at the start of the game and get away from it? I don't know, but it sounds true and feels true. And it's something that you can almost feel in your gut as you're watching a football game. Like, they know that they can run the ball, and they're going to do it on this team, and this team cannot do anything to stop it. As far as the Packers' needs, the reflexive, I think, opinion here is that they're probably looking for an Aaron Jones replacement. Let's gently push back on that. Possibly they're looking for an Aaron Jones replacement. My guess is they're probably just looking to add more talent to the running back room than a specific archetype. And you're probably not going to find a one-to-one Aaron Jones replacement anyway, because he's such a rare back, both in Packers history and I think league-wide. There just aren't many running backs like Aaron Jones. On top of that, Brian Gutekunst has been fairly open this offseason about wanting a bigger-bodied back. You've got Josh Jacobs. You've got A.J. Dillon back. You've got Emmanuel Wilson on the roster. So are we going to look for another one of those bigger-bodied guys, or are we looking for a combo breaker kind of there? I would guess that if they draft somebody, whoever they end up getting is going to look more like a Jacobs or a Dillon than Jones, just because there are more of that kind of draft guy in this year's draft than there are the willowy track stars like Aaron Jones. That's not to say there isn't at least one category, one guy that I would put in the Aaron Jones type of at least body type category, but you're going to find a lot more of your Josh Jacobs and A.J. Dillon types than your Aaron Jones types. There's just more of them in this year's draft class. So looking at this year's class, looking at running backs in general, what are we looking for? Athletes first and foremost. It's not the be-all, end-all, but the job of most running backs is to move the ball quickly. So rather than just looking at overall athleticism, relative athletic score is something we consider, but it's not a primary thing with running backs. What we look at is speed score. It's a great metric developed by Bill Barnwell, then of Grantland.com, then, you know, kind of consumed into the overall ESPN body of work there. Basically, he devised it as a way to look at how quickly guys can move mass on a scale of 0 to 100. Well, I guess there's no technical upper limit to speed score, but it's scaled to be around 100, 100 being about the line that you want to look for. It measures how well you can run at heavier weights, higher numbers being better. And within this metric, running moderately fast at a big weight is better than running really fast at, say, like 160 pounds. If you've got a guy who's a world-class track athlete, but he's only 145 pounds, his speed score isn't going to be as impressive as, say, like an Eddie Lacy type, who ran fast for a guy who was 230-something pounds, depending on at what point in his career that you wanted to measure him. So speed score is what we're going to look at first and foremost. We're also going to look at guys that score. There is some weak correlation between guys who score a lot of touchdowns in college and have NFL success. So we set a fairly low threshold there. We're looking at guys who scored 0.75 touchdowns or more per game in college. That's running and receiving. Then we want pass catchers. This is a crucial part of the game, but it's hard to quantify. The quality of receptions is often quite low for running backs. They're catching a lot of balls at or behind the line of scrimmage, which is not a really high-value thing. We're just looking for guys that were part of their team's passing game in college. So we're looking for guys that had one catch per game or more. So tier one backs are going to be guys that have a 100 speed score or higher, scored 0.75 touchdowns per game or more, and logged one or more catches per game in college. Tier two backs are your 100 or more speed score guys and one or more catches per game. And then tier three, we're just looking for absolute pure raw athleticism. So guys that scored a 9 or higher in relative athletic score and guys who had a speed score of 100 or more. So your big bodied, just monster athletes here. And as it so happens, our first running back off the board in this preview is one such back. We're talking about Trey Benson out of Florida State, who clocks in at number 75 on the consensus mock draft big board. So that's where we're kind of setting expectations for this year's draft class. He is a tier three back, an athletic monster who is not very productive, but what an athlete he is. 9.7 relative athletic score. His speed score of 116 is the second highest in this year's class. He ran a blistering 4.39 40-yard dash at 216 pounds. Just over 6 feet tall, again, 216 pounds. An absolute athlete's athlete. Reminds me of Christian Michael, who had a cup of coffee with the Packers in 2016. But as a player, you can see on his highlight stuff, on everything about him, that he is just trying to out-athlete everyone when he is on the field. And the knock on him, and I think this shows up when you look at how he plays, is that he's fairly unsophisticated as a runner. Doesn't set up blocks, doesn't look for cutback lanes. He's just trying to get to the edge as quickly as possible. Pro Football Focus puts it this way, quote, "High missed tackles forced is more about speed to power and erasing pursuit angles than it is one-cut elusiveness," end quote. And that, again, really shows up on the highlights. A lot of plays where he's either bouncing it outside or they design something to go outside and he's just trying to get to the sideline as quickly as possible and then get upfield, going to outrun everybody to the edge and then get upfield as quickly as possible, which is not a bad way to do it if you can get away with it. It's just not a real sustainable way to build a ground game. Fun fact here, he is the first player in Florida State University history with an 80-yard or more touchdown catch and an 80-yard or more touchdown run. And considering how long the Seminoles have been playing football, that to me is fairly impressive. Next up is the guy I think comes closest to being a one-to-one Aaron Jones replacement. It is Jalen Wright out of Tennessee, who's number 79 on the big board as of our data. A tier one back here. Speed score of 114, ran a 4.38 at 210 pounds. 0.75 touchdowns per game in his career on the dot. 1.25 catches per game. He passes all of our thresholds here. Again, not a big guy, 5'10", 210 pounds, but he has done it all and has done it well. I like that he's been a producer since day one in his college career. He appeared in 9 games for Tennessee as a true freshman after missing his entire senior season of football due to the pandemic. That is fairly impressive to me, and he's just added to that as long as he's been in Tennessee. The bad is that he's a pretty short-term prospect here. He's played just 24 college games in his career, just finished his true junior season. That bothers me less at running back than practically anywhere else, and he was very productive, so take that for whatever it's worth to you. He seems pretty clean as a prospect to me, wants to go into broadcasting after his NFL career, so a fun fact for you there. Also says he models his game after Alvin Kamara, who of course played at Tennessee, but it seems like a pretty good comparison to me given their height and comparative builds and what they do with the football. Wright seems like a really promising and interesting prospect. Next up, past our usual threshold of the top 100, but there are just so few notable running backs in this year's class that we're going to expand things out a little bit here and talk about Marshawn Lloyd, prospect number 107 out of USC, a tier two prospect, a speed score of 111, 1.06 catches per game, 34 catches in 32 career games. Fun body type here, 5'8 and 3/4 and 220 pounds. He looks exactly as you would picture him. If you have not seen a picture of Marshawn Lloyd, he's a muscly little running back. Similar to Trey Benson in his kind of overall scouting profile, but a little bit more involved in the passing game. Not quite as good of an athlete, but comparable and a good enough athlete, I think, to play at the NFL level. He is, I think, similar to Trey Benson as well in that he's a big-bodied athlete who generally works to bounce things outside. And that, I think, is just a downside to a lot of the running backs you watch in college. Running back is one of those positions, and cornerback kind of falls into this. Wide receiver falls into this. You get this a little bit with edge rushers, too. A lot of them don't ever really have to learn how to be football players. When you are, well, when you are a Trey Benson or when you are a Marshawn Lloyd, why would you bother learning how to run behind your blocks or, you know, set up plays or set up cutbacks or stuff like that? When you run a 4.3 range 40, you're 220 pounds. Hardly anybody who can keep up with you, and anybody who can, you're just going to run over them anyway. Why would you bother trying to do it any other way? It always reminds me of, like, I don't know, well, let's use the example, playing the NCAA college football game back when it was the real version, not the version we're going to get this fall. You can, you know, try to play super realistically. You can try to do all the things that match up with how real football is played, Or you could do like I did, and just about everybody I know did. You could just recruit the fastest dudes out there and just be faster than every team that you ever play and run all the money plays and go undefeated every year and have the Heisman winner every year and this, that, and the other thing. It's the same kind of deal. If you've got something that works, there's no reason to learn to play a different way just because that's how you're going to have to play later. It's working for me now. Why would I bother? I'm just making things harder for myself if I'm trying to run the offense exactly as designed. Look, I am the offense when I'm an elite college running back. I can just be more of me than anybody else, and it's going to work fine for me. And that's true. It works for almost all of these guys. You look at, let's use a dated example. Look at Reggie Bush in college. He did not have to run an offense at USC because he just was the offense. The offense was Reggie Bush doing Reggie Bush things a lot of the time. Why would you play any differently if you're just smoking, you know, Pac-12 guys that are going to be an accountant in 3 years? I'm not bothering to learn another way to play. So knocking these guys for that, I think, is legit, but it's also a knock that is a hard sell, I think, for a lot of these college guys, because why would they do anything differently? Back to Lloyd, a fun fact about him, in his home state of Delaware, he spent some time volunteering with the Shop with Jocks program, which, according to his official college bio, he goes Christmas shopping with kids from the Epworth Children's Home back again in his home state of Delaware. Nice story there as well. Rounding out our really in-depth guys, Ray Davis from at 135 on the big board is the last that I want to really spend any time talking about. Played at Kentucky, a tier one prospect, a speed score of 101, 0.93 touchdowns per game, 2.14 catches per game in his college career. Did a lot of things, especially his final season at Kentucky, catching the ball there. I think had something like 70-some catches his final season at Kentucky. 5'11", 211 pounds, very, very productive. Scores a lot, catches the ball a lot, but not an overwhelming athlete. Really borderline on the speed score numbers, not an elite tester by relative athletic score, though good in the sevens range there. He also had a season-ending injury at Vanderbilt in 2021. So if you're looking for guys with clean injury histories, look away from Ray Davis. Fun facts about him, I'll give you two. His given name isn't Ray. It's Raymond Walter Zamar Jamar Davis. I think that's a lot of fun. More middle names, the better. He had a 150-yard game for your second bonus fact, or second fun fact. He had a 150-yard rushing game with three different college programs. Had one at Temple, where he started his career, then had one at Vanderbilt, and then he had one at Kentucky as well. Again, a productive, productive college player. Some quick notes on a few other guys. Prospect number 163 on the big board is Isaiah Guerrero out of Louisville, tier two prospect. The highest speed score in the class at 125. Big, heavy guy, but ran really fast at the combine. 9.97 relative athletic score. He did not have stats kind of in line with a guy who tested like that, but he was involved in their passing game, and it's hard to ignore a guy who is that athletic. At 219 on the big board, Tyrone Tracy Jr. out of Purdue, a tier two prospect, almost identical profile to Guerrero, not quite as big or as fast, but he was a great athlete who caught a lot of passes, though he did not find the end zone much. 113 career catches in the passing game for the Boilermakers. Even wilder, he played in 61 career college games. These COVID-era guys are playing just tons and tons of college football. I wonder if that ends up shaking out and how long their NFL careers are. Nothing to really be done about it, but that's just how it was for a bunch of guys there for a few years. We're kind of coming out of that, but we got to pay attention to it and make a note of it as it comes up. Finally, Michael Wiley out of Arizona, tier two guy, 101 speed score, 2.5 catches per game, 4.5, 140 at 210 pounds, racked up 123 catches in 48 career college games. Very, very active in their passing game. Other notes here, two guys I want to kind of keep an eye on here. The first is prospect number 103, Audric Estime, or Esteem. I'm not sure how you say his last name. Should have looked that up before we recorded today. Out of Notre Dame, if Brian Gutekunst is looking for a big-bodied guy, there are few that are more of the bruising style than this fella. One of the most big-bodied guys in this year's draft. Will probably be a bit of a riser, too. He ran a 4.71 at the combine, which is bad, but he ran a 4.54 at his pro day, which is at least respectable. Importantly, that takes his speed score from 89 to 104. Unfortunately, he did not meet the productivity thresholds, but I think we have a little bit of a type from Brian Gutekunst. He's really been sniffing around a lot of the big name kind of high profile backs, in free agency and the trade market the past couple of years. Look, I just don't know if he wants a big bodied guy. I don't know if we can ignore a big bodied kind of famous school guy. It seems to fit the profile. Also of note, very small school guy out of South Dakota State, Isaiah Davis, prospect number 157 on the big board. He is a hair away from being a tier one prospect. I'm talking about the slimmest possible margins. He met the productivity numbers for touchdowns per game, which is a lot easier to do playing at South Dakota State, but he did meet them. He met the receiving numbers far and away, was very involved in their receiving game, but did not hit the speed score number. And I mean, he came as close as you possibly can to breaking 100 without breaking 100. He ran a 4.57 40-yard dash at 218 pounds, which works out to a speed score of 99.95895. I mean, if he gets a butterfly's wings flap worth of tailwind behind him, he breaks 100 in the speed score. He was that close. He's just an interesting prospect to me. I think he's probably going to be a better prospect than a lot of guys who get drafted ahead of him, just because he played at a small school, but he was very productive. Again, kind of maybe slightly bigger, but in that Aaron Jones sort of mold, an interesting sort of guy too. Hugely productive at South Dakota State. Mainly just wanted to mention how close he was to really lighting up on my draft spreadsheet here, but just did not quite break it. Anyway, that's all I've got for you in this episode of Blue 58. I appreciate you tuning in. I'd appreciate it even more if you'd take a second and share this episode with someone you think would enjoy it. That's going to help more people find the show and get more people involved in this conversation you and I are having about the Green Bay Packers, which in turn is going to help all of us, me included, become smarter Packers fans. And as I always say, smarter Packers fans are better Packers fans, and better Packers fans are what we all want to be. I'm your host, John Meerdink. We'll see you next time on Blue 58.